Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. The Arkansas Chamber Singers has given its Christmas concerts recently in the Old State House Museum, a setting not only artistically, but more importantly, acoustically satisfying. So satisfying that it bids fair to becoming a tradition. John Irwin, director of choral studies at UCA in Conway, is the artistic director and conductor of the Chamber Singers and gives details of the program as well as the theme for the 2015-16 season.
This sort of is a building on last year's program as well. Last year's program dealt with a music that came from war and from conflict. And this season is about peace. So singing about peace was the thrust of the first program. And we did some of the Rachmaninoff Vespers and several other pieces that referenced peace. And then this, of course, it's very easy to lock into the season of peace. Christmas is...
So this year's Christmas is going to be at the State House again?
It is at the Old State House Museum, and we love the acoustic and we love the crowds that come. Where inevitably every program is the house is packed, but the overall feeling in the room is terrific when we're singing. And some years ago, I brought my UCA choir Christmas Madrigal Feast to the Old State House and loved that, and it was wonderful. But it was our event required several things that the Old State House would not allow, and that was, first of all, live candles. And so we were not able to continue that. But I've always remembered that acoustic in the room. And so when I started doing the Chamber Singers, I immediately thought, we'll do something here. We were looking for a locale that we could count on every year, and that everybody else in the community could count on for the Chamber Singers to do their Christmas program. The one drawback to that is that we haven't taken this to the very beautiful sanctuaries around the town. And at some point we will continue that, I think.
And do something of what you do for the other shows, is you go to one church and then to another, or to the Clinton Library or something like that.
Exactly. It seems that we open up the audience. Every time we go to another locale, we attract a new audience, and we like to include as many people as possible, obviously, in our programs.
But the State House, it could be, as it seems to be now, a tradition, and that with Christmas and everything else, and the churches having their own Christmas programs, you're probably wise to keep it to a non-denominational performance.
And that was also in the mix in terms of our thinking. Mm-hmm. So
this particular program that you worked to put in back into the State House, do you have instruments?
Occasionally we'll have a solo instrument here and there, but that is the one big drawback. It's very difficult, and actually it was impossible. We tried to get a grand piano in the room, and we were not able to do so.
Could you use sort of Christmas musicians and the type of instrumentation that goes way back that still would sound lovely?
We have used some flutes and strings before, but in this particular program, we'll be using a keyboard that will be able to duplicate some sounds, mm-hmm. but it won't be the authentic Renaissance sound.
But another thing I think we've talked about, and this was particularly in reference to the programs at the Clinton Library, was the a cappella pieces.
Yes.
Will there be some of those?
There will be mostly a cappella, the Old State House, because that acoustic really does enhance the a cappella sound.
And that in itself sounds Christmassy.
Yes.
When you don't have any kind of instruments, will not have quite the same acoustical value that the voice does.
When I started studying music, I started studying as an instrumentalist because there was no choir in my hometown where I grew up. And so I actually studied an instrument. But the old adage is that every instrumentalist wants to make their instrument sing. And so eventually I came around to singing, and that's where I am now.
Where you found the instrument that you needed to work with.
Yes.
In this particular season, you don't have a separate third concert. You're joining all the other sounds on stage for the Brahms Requiem.
Correct.
And I wondered about that, as to whether the singers themselves have a hard time fitting in everything in a season, and to have a number of rehearsals together and also in the mass sound takes a lot of getting together of people who work in the day and work in the night sometimes.
Yes.
And so it puts a burden on the group as a whole if they have to work on new or fairly difficult material that is not necessarily one that's familiar with them, and find that there are holes in the different sections that sometimes are there and sometimes aren't, and you depend on the singer beside you.
Yes.
With that.
Well, in our thinking about the Brahms Requiem, and when I talked with Philip Mann last year about this, I soon realized that it would be almost impossible to do another program unless we extended our season a lot further. And the Brahms Requiem is one of the greatest pieces for the voice ever. And so I wanted my singers to participate in that because I thought that this would be good for them, and then I also thought that we would be a stabilizing force in the greater ensemble. We rehearse every Tuesday night, 7:15 to 9:45, and the Brahms Requiem really requires a great deal of rehearsal. So I knew that we wouldn't be able to duplicate another, or at least our time would not allow us to prepare another program. I am regretful, quite frankly, that we are not doing something on our own, but perhaps we'll work something out. But the fact is that the Brahms Requiem is our high point for the season.
Yeah. And you're having to do it in German?
Sorry?
You're doing it in German.
Oh, yes. It's there is by the way, a very nice English translation that was done by Robert Shaw. But the fact is that any language, if you write a particular piece in any language, it sings much better in that language, no matter what the translation.
When I was doing my degrees, we did it in English.
Ah.
But it wasn't Robert Shaw's translation. Mm-hmm. It was reading it English and knowing the German. It was almost word for word what the language is used,
mm-hmm.
and the Bible from which it was taken, a lot of it, just sounded right.
Yes.
And made it easier, of course, for all our students to...
Yes, and there... Now, I've not participated in a German Requiem that was sung in English, but I have been told this before, but every time I've done this piece, I've sung it a few times and conducted a choir in it a few times. However, I will say that Brahms, he was actually a biblical scholar. He hand-selected every one of these scripture passages, and he wanted it to be totally inclusive. He didn't want to eliminate anyone. So it's a very broad, opening, welcoming for all races, all peoples, all belief systems. It was not really a denominational uh-huh. or specific even to Christian religion.
But, well, let's talk for a minute, because we haven't touched on what the actual works are that you're going to be performing for the peace concert.
Well, we're going to do two settings of Omani Mysterium, and the first is one of the most famous from the Renaissance, Victoria setting of Omani Mysterium, and then we'll follow that with Martin Lauritsen's setting of Omani Mysterium, and he is one of the new composers that have set this work. Actually, if you look in the catalog, there are probably 100 settings of this text. But his setting is incredibly powerful and fits the meaning of the word, oh, wondrous mystery. And actually, this piece is about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It has had some readings in Arkansas, but we hope this will be the quintessential one. This entire program, we are mixing some very lofty choral works with some very traditional carols. So we'll sing something that may come from the Renaissance. We are doing a Marenzio, Odia Christus Natus Est, for my money, one of the best settings of that text. And then we're doing a very upbeat, traditional setting by Edwin Fissinger of On Christmas Night. A Mendelssohn, How Lovely Are the Messengers, that preach us the gospel of peace. Several Robert Shaw and mm-hmm. Alice Parker arrangements of carols that some very well known. I saw Three Ships, What Child Is This, Good Christian Men Rejoice, and then some very unusual ones like the Carol of the Birds. That actually was new for me, but it's a setting by Robert Shaw and Alice Parker. And then we're doing a couple of John Rutter carols to round it out. We Wish You a Merry Christmas, then.
When I was a student at SMU, Lloyd Fauch was my choir director and teaching me how to direct.
Yes.
And he was a great one for composing and trying them out on the choirs first.
Right.
And there was a lovely jazzy one that he did for Christmas.
Of which text? We Wish You a Merry Christmas?
No, I think it was more Tomorrow Will Be My Dancing Day.
Okay. Lloyd Fauch was a terrific composer, done several things of his. As I've gotten older, I noticed that all the choral directors, the young, but I find that they focus on the very latest compositions, and they forget to go back and look at what repertoire there has been in this country as well as other countries. That's the great thing about being a choral director. We have music that goes all the way back.
No,
you know, I'm not aware of anything, but Michael Head, I've sung some solo songs of his. Michael Head is a terrific composer.
Yeah. No, there's still a lot of work that hasn't been presented to the public in the same way that it does at Christmas and other seasons.
As long as you are alive, you should seek out new works, and you should seek out older works that have somehow slipped off the table. And there are many of them. And we try to do that, find something every year that hasn't been performed quite as much. The composer I mentioned earlier, Edwin Fissinger, who for years was the director of choral activities and theory teacher at North Dakota State University, and he has written some marvelous Christmas settings, and we are doing a couple of those on the program this year. But every year, I used to do every year a piece by him, and he doesn't seem to be that well known. We're actually doing a premiering a piece by one of our own singers, Jordan Bennett, who Jordan did his master's degree in choral conducting with me at UCA, and he is a composer and has written this piece, The Setting of Love Came Down at Christmas. It's very beautiful, and I think everyone will be moved by this piece.
That was John Irwin, Artistic Director and Conductor of the Arkansas Chamber Singers. The 2015 December Christmas concerts, titled The Peace of Christmas, present three performances in the Old State House Museum in downtown Little Rock. Friday and Saturday, December 11th and 12th at 7 p.m., and Sunday, December the 13th at 3. Admission is free. Out of the silence of the Delta comes my second guest today, artist Norwood Creech, who hails from Lepanto, some of whose paintings of the Delta in northeast Arkansas are up at Drawl Southern Contemporary Art in Little Rock's Heights neighborhood. She paints as she feels, and in the following interview, tells it as only she can, in words as colorful as her paintings. Why did you decide to have this new exhibit with a lot of new paintings in it in this tiny little gallery in an area where it's very hard to find and to park, just for fun or just because you wanted people to see what you were doing so you could talk about it?
To be frank, Guy asked me, so I said yes. For the past 2 years, I've been rotating 20 pieces. I went from Wilson Cafe in Wilson, Arkansas, when Galen Lawrence started that fluffing of Wilson, which was great. Then I took it to East Arkansas Community College. Then I took the art down to El Dorado, South Arkansas Art Center down there. Those folks are great stewards. And then Bill Branch let that work hang at the Delta Cultural Center through this past summer. And in the meantime, I'm still producing work. So I had over 40 pieces of work, and the work's getting bigger, and I'm working on location, and it's getting more. It's piling up. So when Guy said, would you like a show, I had a place to put it.
So let's go back a bit. Where and when did you meet Guy?
I'd only known him on Facebook and the telephone. But the only time I think I ever had a direct conversation with him was when he called and said, I'm opening a gallery. Do you want to play?
And then this description of his journey out to your house, the first time he visited you, was soon after the offer of the gallery or before the offer of the gallery?
That was after. That was when they were finally going to come out. He and his wife, Mary, were going to come out and call. And he had not been out yet. And I had requested they at least give me 2 hours. And 4 hours, and they still didn't get through everything.
And it took them that long to get out there?
It takes 2.5 hours to drive from Little Rock out to Lepanto.
So long as you don't get behind a Pantechnicon, they won't let you.
Well, I cut across 14. It's colorful. Stay away from the interstate.
I'd seen at the Art Center, what, 3-4 years ago?
Well, I curated a show for the Art Center.
Ah, that's what it was.
Yes. That was Horizons Interrupted. Yeah. When I was curator for a day, and I purchased that at the Tabriz auction. That was a lot of fun. Yeah. I highly recommend going to the Tabriz auction.
And doing it, you were seeing from the other side of the fence. Did that make a difference when somebody asks you to come and put a show up?
I think the tools are the same. The thought process, the thinking, the critical analyzation of what makes beauty and what's successful, and if you're charging on all 8 cylinders or if you only got 6 and you're missing some texture, you need some contrast or sparkle, or, you know, all that stuff is the same to me.
Yeah.
And as a third generation artist, and it being a natural part of the conversation, it's just natural.
Third generation of artist as in painter or writer or singer or what?
Painter. My mother's mother, most people knew her as Kitty, but her paintings were signed K. Doyle Ford. She has 3 in the National Portrait Gallery. Painted lawyers, governors, senators, la, la, la. But Formal Oils, she held a studio above Café des Artistes, was a protege of Howard Chandler Christie, first woman in the National Art Club. And my mother, her only child, retaliated and painted watercolor portraits like Mary Cassatt. So she did not do Formal Oils where people sat. She raised me doing watercolor portraiture. And then a few years ago, she segued into period furniture. And now she deals with some of the top auction houses around the world. But I've done the dog and pony show with her. So to transfer the skills on how to see, you know, furniture, art, small, silver, whatever it is, you know, it's about beauty to me.
Yeah. And when you see things beautiful, do you covet them or do you try to bring out in your work the things that you've found in other people's that you like so much because they've discovered something that you'd like to discover as well?
Now come again?
When you go and see a painting, like you mentioned before we went on the air about the Turners,
oh, wow, yeah.
And you see something like that, and you see it, and you think, now, how can I get that? Or how can I get into that kind of creativity that would give me the same pleasure that I'm getting from Turner?
It is for me to allow myself to enjoy and exist and be. Whether it be Turner or a sunset or anything that's beautiful, I'm always very tempted to capture pictures. But in the end, it's the rubber for me hits the road when I look at reality and I try to express it with my hands and it goes through that filter. And that's my conversation right now. And most of my work is on location. But winter's coming on. We'll see. I may go back to still lives. It gets cold outside.
Yeah. But what you've got up in the gallery in town at the moment is mostly your surroundings.
I work probably, I stay within about 20-mile radius of Lepanto, but there's plenty within a 20-mile radius. We have Dice, which is boyhood home to Johnny Cash, Taranza, which has the Southern Tenant Farmers Museum, the Midway Cafe, and Jill and Keith Forrester, Witten Farms, now have Ty Boogie's Cafe. Mark Tree, over by Mark Tree, we got the Siphons, Floodway, when you come around to Truman. Come through the Floodway, Rivervale, Sunken Lands, and then back to Lepanto. There's a lot right there in that 20-mile radius.
And how long have you lived there?
I married Try in 2000, so since 2016.
And you've moved out of state, grown up in other places?
I had been living on the West Coast, and then the riots came, and I was in Southern California, moved to Bisbee, Arizona, and was part of my decompression process. And then I moved to Memphis, and I'd been doing still lifes and playing with plein air painters, the older dudes out in California. In Memphis, I bought a house in Central Gardens, and it was a little claustrophobic. I was used to ocean and desert and open space, and I started running the levees, and that's how it all began. I fell in love.
And where were you born?
I was born in Kansas City, but raised in Louisville, Kentucky. College education with an art degree in Skidmore College, which is in Saratoga Springs, New York. And then a little time in South Carolina, designing education programs. And then in Southern California for the Laguna Art Museum, the Bowers Museum. You know, matriculating.
Well, I would think that that kind of an, I wouldn't say upbringing, you brought yourself up in many ways. This has given you a taste for your country, and that means the whole United States, except you've left out the mountains.
Well, I need some elbow room. Mountains would get in the way, wouldn't they?
But if you're born in the mountains, then nothing else gives you quite the same peace or acceptance that you're where you almost belong.
I never knew I belonged here until I got here. And then when I got here, it was like harmony within. The vibrations kind of, everybody got along.
The pieces of the puzzle began to fit.
Mm-hmm. In a lovely way that resonated within me and didn't have to do with anybody else.
So when you painted in all these other places, what did you paint?
Historically, from college on up to California, still lifes. And then I started playing around with landscapes. And landscapes, get outside, paint.
Now, did the landscapes that you painted come up in all the places you lived? So instead of photographs or sketches, you had real paintings?
There were just a few landscapes. There were really more still lifes. And in California, I was a big admirer of Wayne Thiebaud and Diebenkorn and followed those kind of painters, painterly painters.
Mm-hmm. And what did they use? Mostly oils, watercolors, mm-hmm. pastels?
Mm-hmm. Oils. Diebenkorn's a great Northern California painter. Wayne Thiebaud's pretty popular. Cakes. If you think of Wayne's cakes, they're good.
Not as good as fried pies.
San Francisco versus Arkansas Delta, you know, each its own.
Yes. But now you paint mostly what's around you, which light is bringing out which aspect of it.
Well let me set you up with, I saw the Arkansas Delta. I fell in love with a guy who, his family happens to own a lot of land and cotton gin, et cetera, and so on. And as we teasingly say, I married him for his landscape. But in this process of being in an agricultural family, I have learned how this landscape works. My husband's Southern Cotton Ginners, National Cotton Council, flood control, really getting involved with the stewardship and conservation and how the land is worked and leveled and archaeology and it's not just a drive-by, hey, there's a picture, and I'm going to go home and paint that picture I just took driving through the Delta. It's different. It's a savory thing. It's
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe it. You know, how do you describe how you love something or why you love something?
It depends how much of you is put into that description or loving.
Drowning.
Yeah, really. Well,
but when I think about it bigger, like you said about, you know, it's a piece of America. And when I back up, it gets a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel so finite because it's changing radically out there.
Yeah. And so all this, you mentioned the Delta, that when we talked about the Gar before mm-hmm. we started talking. You're on the fault close enough, aren't you?
As a matter of fact, University of Memphis has a sensor on one of our farms.
And we had a lot of people writing in or little stories recently about the tremors when they started fracking. And Rudyard Kipling has a... Is it Rudyard Kipling? Maybe it's the chap who wrote Sherlock Holmes. Has a short story called The Day the Earth Screamed. And it was because somebody was trying to get down into the heart of the world. And the world didn't like it. So you start doing things below ground, and the earth, the world, will react.
It kind of reminds me of the shaman who cares for the spirit that involves not just the village but the nature
mm-hmm.
and the peoples and their hearts and dispositions and keeping everything in balance.
Yes.
With care.
And there's a certain amount of acceptance of what happens when you do that. So that you're not constantly fighting to address what you think is dislocation, but it just happens to be a movement that is building into something else.
Well, that might apply to this harvest. I was running around painting, and there was a lot of rice burning. And it was an issue for me because it made it difficult to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to get up on a soapbox, but then I realized that was misspent energy, and really, I'm a landscape painter. I paint what's in front of me. That's what's in front of me. Go get it. And what turned out, what started out as being, oh, I just can't stand this smoke, and this is bad, and it's horrible for everybody. It's worse than secondhand smoke, turned into a great experience to understand expression and painting mm-hmm. and nature, and I learned more from that than if there hadn't been smoke.
And you got several of those paintings up in this show, and you're explaining them to me, the different colors that you'd brought into the smoke and what it was that we were looking at that was what was so evil, that was doing so much harm without you realizing it.
Yeah, is that orange in those smoke clouds? Mm. Is that really iron?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, we'll see.
Yeah. Now, like Van Gogh and some of these other painters of the past who have taken the same scene in different times of day, in different shadows, in different effects of the nature around them. Is that what you do too?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you wake up and I'm always looking, yeah. Or I'd like to say I'm always looking if I'm on my game.
The only trouble is that it'll never, ever be the same.
No, and that to me is where it's exciting. It's listening to my eyes when they see something that makes them go, oh, I want that.
Mm.
And getting everything else in line to stop, get the studio, portable studio set up, and to experience it. And then there's that day. And then the next day, something else might. And it's my responsibility to be able to relate with that and discipline that. I'm not always the best at that, but that's my goal, and I practice every day.
Norbert Creech is an Arkansas artist whose paintings, personality, and words will entice you. Go to Draw Southern Contemporary Art at 5208 Cavanaugh Boulevard in Little Rock Heights District through December the 14th. The show is titled The Flatlander, Depictions of the Delta by agricultural artist Norbert Creech. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.